The scripture is found in Jeremiah 31 through 35, and the pew page is 680. The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel. After that time, declares the Lord, I will put my law in their minds and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness, and I will remember their sins no more.
We all pretty much like to receive new things, don't we? New clothes, new cars, some new shoes, even though they got more than they can wear. A new job. Some people receive new leases on life with new shoulders, new hips, new knees, or even a new heart. And I heard that. I don't think that they've perfected the brain transplant yet. Dr. Frankenstein proved that's a more difficult task. But some even get new hearts through transplants. And we often talk to each other and to others about receiving new life in and through Christ, something that excites many, rightfully so. After all, that should excite us because we are people of the new covenant, right? And in fact, we say New Testament is the new covenant. Old Testament is the old covenant. And the text today, which is sometimes overused and oftentimes misused, and I hope that's not going to be the case today, but this text today speaks of a new covenant. A new covenant that God says will no longer be a covenant of stone and old tablets, but will be a covenant written upon the heart. And I want us to think today about what that grand news means, because actually, that's good news. That is gospel. A covenant which is written upon the heart, which is placed within the life, what I call a covenant of the heart. It's great news for us, corporately, yes, as kingdom of God, but individually, which is a major hallmark of Jeremiah's preaching. The passage may be one of the single most important teachings in the whole book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah does, although Isaiah touches upon it a little bit, Jeremiah is the prophetic person credited most with moving away from, oh, well, I can blame my sins on my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and on back, to it is upon one's individual heart that judgment will come, and from one's individual sins or proper actions. And that's the case here. The promise is corporate, but the covenant is also individualistic. The passage is so important, it links with others and even moves into our understandings of the new covenant in the New Testament. Now, this promise, if we were to read before and even after this particular passage, This promise is made to a people who are in exile. And they're in exile because of their pervasive unfaithfulness to God. They've continually been unfaithful in a variety of ways. And while they are physically in exile, what may be even more instructive for us is they are spiritually in exile as well. And sometimes we find ourselves maybe not so much physically out there as we do spiritually apart from God. In fact, in chapter 11 of Jeremiah, there are several specific, in the first seven verses, several specific problems that show Israel's unfaithfulness. So they're in exile and they have begun to wonder whether God just may have rejected them or not. Those questions that have been raised. Is God powerful? Has God rejected us? Maybe God doesn't care anymore. So first of all, we need to recognize that this passage in its context is being sent to a people who are in exile, who have separated themselves from God, and who, quite frankly, in many ways are defeated and dispirited. And they sense that great defeat, that dispirited kind of nature. It's a particular group for whom this instruction is given. And yet, as we have been reminded in recent days and in the intro to our Isaiah Bible study on Wednesday mornings, we said last Wednesday that we have to remember that the prophet isn't just a future teller or a fortune teller. The prophet's message must be directed to the people in the time in which that prophet is living. Because prophets were preachers, proclaimers, guides. And so while Jeremiah's speaking here, these verses that we have read are specifically meant for the people in exile at that time. That doesn't preclude their importance for us today or in any time since this exile. The promise has connections to the former one as well, though. The New Covenant. A lot of times we Christians like to take this passage about the New Covenant and just separate it out and say, okay, here this is about Jesus and the New Covenant. And we take it away from the old. I was talking with someone yesterday. Won't give any names. It was at choir practice. Won't give any names, but the initials are Ariel Smith. But we were talking a little bit about this yesterday, Ariel and I, just for a few moments. I reminded her that so many philosophers, but in particular I'm thinking of one, which is not a Christian philosopher, but Confucius. Confucius talked about the chaos in the world was because people had forgotten the old customs and the old traditions and the old knowledge, and they were just grabbing on to anything new. And Confucius taught that the old knowledge is every bit as important as new knowledge, because without the old knowledge, the new knowledge has no foundation. Well, guess what? That's part of what this passage speaks to as well. That new covenant still has connections with the old. It's just that the new covenant will be something that is within and that gives more impetus for doing, for living that covenant than something that's just plastered to the walls. The promise doesn't say that there will be no more sin and death. There's still going to be realities as long as we're alive. And forgiveness will still be necessary. For the text says, and I will forgive them, and I will forgive them, and I will forgive them. But something new is arising. Interestingly enough, this is, if I am correct, and I checked it out, I think I am, this is the only place in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, where the word new is linked with and modifies covenant. Now, we've got everlasting covenant, and other modifiers for covenant, but it's the only place where new is actually used to modify the word covenant, an agreement. As Chris mentioned earlier, it is an agreement. The best definition I ever read of covenant was an agreement between two parties of unequal status with no visible means of enforcing that agreement. In other words, it's an agreement of trust. I covenant with someone, and I say, this is what I will do, and I expect them to do what they do. And if one doesn't, the covenant is broken, and the other party is no longer bound to that covenant. However, we find throughout the Hebrew text that God, in spite of our breaking that covenant, not holding up our end of the bargain, breaking God's trust. If you think about it, God trusts us. That's pretty heady stuff. But then think about how often we break that trust. But in spite of that, God continues to uphold that forgiveness and that love and God's part of the bargain. Now, some scholars argue concerning this particular passage that this means the law goes away completely and is not needed anymore. But that's not so. The law still is an important guide for general living. However, instead of having to be taught the law by rote, instead of having a codified set of rules, God says here through Jeremiah that if people will truly be open, there will be a newness. The law will be felt within the heart. And there will be a newness within the heart and upon the heart. Now, we've said in numerous times before, in many different settings, that within Hebrew thought, the heart was the place where you made your deepest, most important decisions. It was a mixture of both feeling and intellect. But it shouldn't be too surprising that we as Christians or even Jeremiah should be talking about the heart in such a way. Others had done the same thing. And if we move forward in Christian history, it seems to me that somewhere, somebody important said something like, "You shall love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength." It's not the external code, but the internal, inward recognition of the law written upon our hearts that makes the difference. To quote one Old Testament theologian, "The new covenant will confer a new inward motivation and power for fulfilling the law which is already known." End of quote. An inward motivation that is new. It's not so much to come in, and though sometimes I think, and I said last year as we had the little 8-point record system thing that I ran off and put in the bulletin, sometimes we need to have a checklist just to make sure we're doing what we should be. But at the same time, it's not the checklist of laws that makes us keep the law or be in proper relationship with God. It's that inner sense, that inward motivation from which we draw power and strength. But not only for fulfilling the law already made known for us, but for making the law and the new covenant known in a new way for others around us. You've heard that it was said to the men of old, "You shall not kill. But I say to you, anyone who is angry with his brother is liable to the council. Anyone who says racha to him is liable to judgment. And that one who says, you fool, shall be liable to the very Gehenna of fire." I think that same person that said we should love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength said that as well. Jesus. It is therefore to be written and found within our hearts and upon the heart of we who are individual children of God. And not just for our own good, but for the good of the whole. there are these three provisions then in the covenant that Jeremiah gives, all linked to three steps. First of all, some of the old gods that we hold based on the old rules and regulations. Those ways that we sometimes try to confine God and make God manageable. J.B. Phillips, God in a Box. Need to be re-examined. God is not bound by our definitions. It is God who is the measure of all mystery, and that mystery cannot be bound by us and by our definitions and our expectations placed upon God. While we do have expectations from that covenant, there are more expectations that come our way, many of which we would like to forget, but that is part of the covenant with God. God's promise is that the new will not be always the same as the old, finite in scope and understanding, but it will be greater. And it will be an infinite mystery which we can spend all of our lives plumbing the depths. And that is a part of being faithful. That is a part of learning the law, understanding the law written in and upon our hearts, plumbing the depths of that mystery for all of our lives. We don't get to a point where we get to stop and think or say we know it all. As long as we're alive, a part of what we covenant with God about is to live using our hearts and our minds to explore that mystery that is God. It is an infinite mystery of God's deliverance for our own Egypts, as he mentions Egypt here. Or Babylon's, or wherever we might find ourselves apart from God. Another step is not always to be content or locked into just the old. It's not just about go, therefore, and baptize in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. You know, we often are good at skipping over the second step in that commission that Jesus gives us. And it's the same kind of commission that God is giving through Jeremiah and Isaiah and Amos and Hosea and so many others. I was at a meeting recently and somebody stood up and was talking about the Great Commission, and I thought, you know, I've been saying that for years. I hope you haven't just figured it out. But this guy said, you know, we, and he was talking about Baptists, and he said, you know, we Baptists are so good at the first and the third steps. We go and we baptize and get them in the building. But then we don't do the second step. Go make disciples. That is, followers and learners, disciplined disciples. I know you're thinking, there he goes again, talking about that study and learn stuff. Then, baptize. We're very good at skipping the hard part, making disciples, because we get very comfortable with the safe platitudes. And that means we don't have to think about the other stuff. But that's not what God says, and that's certainly not what Jesus says, and that's not what God is talking about here in that new covenant written upon the heart and within the life. Even in Jeremiah's time, people were to become disciplined disciples. Disciples, not just something that happens when Jesus comes along. Jesus tells us to go and make those disciples, teaching them to observe my commandments. And how do you observe the commandments? First, you have to learn them. The new was already arising, but they tried to force it before it could take hold in the heart. God says he will not put the law within them, he will put the law within them and upon their hearts. The eternal mystery of grace, not on stone, not on paper, but within the hearts and the minds attuned to the message, and who covenant with God and with each other to learn to be disciples. Then the third step, forgiveness and love. And we shall know God from the heart. The text says here that we will know Him. The same promise was made as is made to in the past, as is made to us. I will be your God and you will be my people. That doesn't go away. That promise doesn't leave because God talks about the new covenant. It's a covenant in a new way. It still is built upon the old and the promise. I will be your God and you will be my people. Pascal wrote, and I quote, "The law demands what it cannot give. Grace gives what it, that is the law, demands." From the heart. The promise of God is not a sinless world. The promise of God is not sinlessness. We're human beings. But the promise of God is the forgiveness of sin. The continued forgiveness of sin. But forgiveness only brings healing when it is written upon the heart. Interesting word used here in the Hebrew text is the same word as to cut. Written. It's cut into the heart. And then when it heals, it is there and it heals over. It is locked in. That's part of the idea here. And when the response is of the heart, then we truly show that we understand and that we're on that path with God and God's people, which can result not only in the covenant being stronger with we as we are disciples, but those around us. You know, when we are of something, it is part of us who we are, and we are part of it. We speak of our heritage and we say we're of the line of so-and-so, or our parents and our grandparents, and we trace back lineages. That's a big deal these days. Ancestry.com. Except I'm not going to pay to find out more than I've already found out for free. But we talk about our heritages and our lineage, and some things we may not want to know and some we might. But it is part of who we are. It makes up a part of us. But we also contribute to it. And in like fashion, I would suggest that the writing of the law on the heart means that it is to be part and parcel of who we are, and our commitment is one of what and who that covenant is, from whom it might come. It is a covenant within the heart and the mind. If we are God's grace-filled, and why should we not be if God gives us grace? Sometimes I wonder, and I know I don't always show grace like I should, but sometimes I wonder if God gives me grace and is so graceful and grace-filled toward me, how dare I not give grace to others? And yet sometimes we who call ourselves God people are the ones who do that the least. But if we are God's grace-filled and called children who respond to that call in covenant with God, to love God with all the heart, with all the soul, with all the mind, with all the strength, to allow that law written within our hearts and upon our hearts to be part of who we are, then our motivation, our new motivation, doesn't come from ourselves. It is from within. It is of our hearts, so that we might truly be those who share God's covenant. We might be those who, the text says, no longer shall they teach one another or say to each other, know the Lord, for they shall all know me from the least to the greatest, when it is truly a covenant of the heart. Maybe I should change the closing hymn. They'll know we are Christians by our love. By keeping that covenant as disciplined disciples. A promise that we make to God and to each other. But we're going to stick with our hymn that is listed in the bulletin because it talks about promise and covenant. I invite you to take your hymnals and turn to hymn number 676. Oh Jesus, I have promised. Doesn't say I have promised to love thee to the end. It says I promise to serve thee as a covenant of the heart. Our altar is open for any decision that you might make or for anyone who might be listening. We'll even take a phone call. Or I would suggest you talk to someone near you. 676, O Jesus, I have promised.